Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is journalist and author Catherine Stewart, and we're talking about her new book, Money, Lies, and God, Inside the Movement to Destroy American Democracy. Catherine, welcome back to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you.
You as well.
But I have to say, as with your other books, they're very well researched, and you really do the role of a hardcore journalist in this. But they're alarming, and it's the weirdest situation to have a book that I find really frightening. Yet you recommend it to everybody you know. And so, Money, Lies, and God really continues this. Talk to me about how much research you do to put this book together. It seems like you traveled a lot. You would attend these conferences. It's an amazing amount of work you put into these books.
Thank you so much. You know, Money, Lies, and God is my third book on the rise of the religious right as a political force in the anti-democratic movement generally. So this book is really the culmination of 16 years of research and reporting. My first book honed in on the war on public education.
And this was inspired because your daughter, it came up at your daughter's school.
That's absolutely true. You know, in 2008, late 2008, we were living in Santa Barbara, California, and a program of fundamentalist religious indoctrination came to her public elementary school. And it was clear to me pretty quickly that this was a club that aimed to confuse very little kids into thinking that their school endorsed a particular form of religion. And they were, using children attending the club to recruit their peers to the club. And they seemed, frankly, really, you know what I did, Mark? This is what I did. I started asking questions. How is it legal and possible that this kind of program is installed in a public elementary school, given the separation of church and state? So I started researching the legal strategy that had sort of, I recognized that there was a right-wing legal ecosphere that sought to tear down the wall of separation between church and state. They were reconfiguring ideas about religious freedom and freedom of speech in order to undermine the Establishment Clause of the Constitution. And they were really aiming at nothing more than the transformation of education in America at all. You know, 1979, Jerry Falwell laid out the agenda. He said, I hope to see the day when there are no more public schools. Churches will have taken them over and Christians will be running them. So, I mean, this sort of opened a whole area of inquiry for me. I recognized that there was a kind of a war on public education as we know it, but that was just one small part of a much larger war on the foundations of American democracy. And my second book in this area, The Power Worshippers, focuses on the Christian nationalist movement and the sort of deep organizational infrastructure of that movement. And then Money, Lies, and God talks about the religious right or the Christian nationalist movement as one component of a larger anti-democratic movement that has various different features.
And that's one of the aspects I found really interesting and useful in this book, because there's several groups of people that are sort of working together, but they're not equal. There are people who, the money people, aren't that much into the religion part. They're into the power part and the control part. But it's all about anti-democracy movements in the United States. It's absolutely incredible. Everybody wants to move towards a one-party authoritarian state. And you must have, from the beginning, have found this incredibly alarming and surprising that it was going on underneath your nose.
That's absolutely true. I think the funny thing is that this movement has been hiding in plain sight for many years. It's not that, you know, they're not open about what they want to do. They've been telling us what they want to do, or telling one another what they want to do in the spaces that they share. So, you know, I'm just an investigative journalist, but I don't have any special way to go to these places. I just go where I'm allowed to go. I buy a ticket like everybody else. I use my real name. And I started to sort of see the sort of, you know, when I see the activists talking amongst one another and then see the sort of the affiliated political leaders and the sort of pastor networks and different features of the movement, they're saying what they want to do. They say what they're going to do, then they do it, and then they say that they did it. And it's not like they're hiding. It's like other folks are really not listening to what they want
that's,
to do.
That's exactly what I got out of your book. And when you're attending these conferences, I find it really interesting to read about. You often talk to the people next to you or people in the crowd and just ask them typical questions. And all of them are very paranoid about what's happening in the United States. They all talk about there are going to be Democratic prison camps for them in the future. And then there were certain key words that remind me of the old Three Stooges, like Niagara Falls. Like you mentioned something like woke, or something like trans. And they just spin these wild conspiracy theories about these things. And it's really driven them to distraction. These people, for the most part, who are in the crowds are often just regular middle-class people, but they're caught up in these paranoid delusions that the people who are directing these groups sort of create for them and work them up to be alarmed about.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. You know, the money people, I think, in general, are motivated by economic concerns. They want policies that are going to justify and increase their vast concentrations of wealth. Some are motivated by cultural and religious goals, but others, frankly, aren't. Some of them are really atheistic and see the cost of working alongside sort of religious nationalist leaders as sort of just the price of doing business. But frankly, they know that a lot of their policies that are going to, you know, degrade rights for the workforce and frankly make it a lot harder for American families to succeed are not going to be popular among the rank and file. So they've invested part of their fortunes, or many of them have, in disinformation operations and sort of media networks that are sort of more, I think, aptly described as propaganda networks. And they frame these issues and communicate them to the rank and file in ways that sort of create and shape that kind of paranoia. They're pushing sort of culture war extremism all the time, all day. And I think of those issues, you know, some of the issues you mentioned, like the trans stuff, is almost like, you know what a laser pointer cat toy is?
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's like,
oh, yeah.
Puts this red light on the floor and the cat jumps around, doesn't see anything else. Well, I almost see it like that. Like, whatever you think about those particular issues, they serve as a massive distraction from the larger agenda, the larger anti-democratic agenda this movement is pushing. I mean, let's face it, we're really in a moment of crisis here.
Oh, yeah.
We can see that free speech, the integrity of voting rights, the legitimacy of the courts, opposition to corruption, these core democratic principles and so many others, and so many of our democratic institutions are under attack. But you can't get, you know, the rank and file to vote for the destruction of Medicare and the end of Social Security by itself. It's like you get them to vote for the candidate who's going to promise to protect the American family, even though those policies are actually going to make it harder for their families to succeed.
One of the things you say is that it's a leadership-driven movement.
That's absolutely true. This is a movement that's driven by the leadership and not by the agendas, not set by the rank and file. The leadership, I think, can be divided into some categories.
Right. Funders. You have the, I'll name one, each one in time. You can comment. There's the funders. Now, who are the funders?
Well, the funders are, I would say, the beneficiaries of the vast concentrations of wealth at the very tippy top of the economic ladder. And look, America has a lot of very rich people. They're not all funding this. It's only a sector that are. But here's the interesting thing, Mark. Religiously, they're all over the place. Some are Protestant, some are evangelical, some are Catholic, some are Jewish, some are atheistic. But they're essentially united in this determination to what they, you know, smash the administrative state, basically attack liberalism. But they know, again, that those policies aren't going to be popular. So they fund these disinformation networks. And that's where the lies comes in. And, you know, in this book, I actually also pay a close attention to a group called the Thinkers, which are sort of intellectuals, many of whom are affiliated with the New Right, a sort of movement that is, I would say, less explicitly religious nationalist and more explicitly anti-democratic. And they've been sort of some of them participating in the production of disinformation. And then, of course, you have other engines of disinformation and conspiracism that I feature in Money, Lies, and God. Like, do you know what Reawaken America is?
Yeah, see, there, you know, what was alarming to me throughout your book is there are all these organizations, they have big meetings. I had never heard of most of them. And as a matter of fact, as far as the funders goes, I thought I knew the names of some of the funders, but there's an awful lot. You track down their backgrounds too, and how they came to think that the way they did, by the way. There's all this background information that's amazing. I've never heard of those people. And it's alarming that these people have immense wealth and are funding movements that are reactionary and nihilistic.
Well, think about somebody like Barry Side.
I mean, I didn't know anything about him before your book.
Right. He's a Jewish billionaire. He donated $1.6 billion, that's with a B, as in boy, to fund something called the Marble Freedom Trust, which is, you know, it can spend $230+ million per year without touching the nut. And all of that is supposed to go into, you know, influence right-wing politics and culture. And he put Leonard Leo in charge of it. Now, Leonard Leo is an ultra-conservative Catholic sort of money man of the right-wing legal ecosphere. He built up and formed the Federalist Society into what it is today. It finds and grooms and promotes right-wing talent for the courts. So when you look at the Supreme Court and how kind of unrepresentative it is in terms of its, you know, the justices' political orientations, it really is hard right. And that's not really reflective of where the American people are. Leonard Leo has played a really strong role in helping sort of make that happen. And it's not just candidates for Supreme Court, it's also candidates for the lower courts. So, I mean, it really kind of shows that, you know, is Barry Side really motivated by a desire to end abortion? I mean, I don't think so. I can't tell if he is. I think he's more motivated by kind of almost like certainly a desire to justify the accumulation of wealth that he has, and also perhaps by a certain psychological disposition and then, you know, opposition to a kind of liberalism in general. But what it shows is that a lot of the funders really don't have religious motivations at all, but they're happy to get their rank and file on board.
That's right.
With the Christian nationalism piece of it. And, you know, Christian nationalism is really important piece of this movement, because I would say it's the most important factor in the largest part of this movement, in that it's how the leaders of the movement communicate to a lot of the rank and file. They say you need to vote your biblical values, and the biblical values they cite are never things like helping the poor and the undefended, caring for others.
Well, that was one of the things that's fascinating to read in Money, Lies, and God, is that their image of Jesus is not the traditional image of Jesus at all. You know, as a, you know, helping your neighbor, peace. And they see Jesus as sort of Rambo, and that sounds funny, but it's a violent Jesus. The free market system is God's biblical economy.
That's true. There's some talk about that. It's really interesting. I mean, it's interesting because most of the focus on Christian nationalism is on the base of voters. And that's important because, you know, we have a large number of Americans who are open to the idea that America is a Christian nation and should be ruled by Christians of a certain type, like, you know, conservative Christians. But I really have made a lot of effort in my book to draw attention to the role of these power brokers or power players within that part of the movement, the pastors who have joined into networks that you know, band together, sort of turn out their congregations to vote, because those folks have frankly made a career out of promoting Christian nationalist ideas and their engagement in the Christian nationalist movement. And they too have gained a lot of power and influence through that kind of voter manipulation.
And they really believe that the separation of church and state is not a thing that the founders believed in.
You know, this is true. I mean, it's interesting. The first thing to note, I think, here is just because something is in the Constitution doesn't mean it's being sort of honored by all of our judges or playing out on the ground. Separation of church and state has been under intense attack for decades, and the wall of separation is crumbling fairly quickly right now. I mean, the most serious changes have been made possible by a radical Supreme Court that has been stacked with individuals who really don't believe those First Amendment protections. They've reframed religious liberty or religious freedom as the right of people of certain conservative religious beliefs to exempt themselves from the laws that apply to everyone else, and also to derive special tax privileges and also, in some instances, public subsidies. Right.
Yeah.
And then they've used that principle as an attack on civil rights. They're really opening also the spigots of public funding for right-wing churches and religious groups. And, you know, this really matters to our democracy. I mean, the separation of church and state is foundational to the principle of religious freedom. The idea that you have the right to worship any god or sacred idea or none, but you also have the right to not have to worship if you don't want to, and you have the right to not have to support another person's religion with your tax dollars if you don't want to. In fact, several of our founders characterized sort of required support of other religions with their tax dollars as tyranny. They used that word, tyranny. So, I mean, because of the separation of church and state, we have a lot of individual rights. These are valuable things to have. It's wonderful to live in a society where you can worship any way you want to, and that doesn't have any bearing on your rights and abilities to participate as a citizen in our democracy. I think that's an intrinsically valuable principle, and I think our founders understood that.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is journalist and author Catherine Stewart. And we're talking about her new book, Money, Lies, and God, Inside the Movement to Destroy American Democracy. There are so many things we could be talking about, and I want to make sure I get certain things in before we run out of time. I want to talk about the war on public schools. One of the interesting things that I learned from your book is that actually started post-bellum, way back. There were problems during Reconstruction with the idea of public schools. There were certain people who were against it.
That's true. People like Robert Louis Dabney thought that public schools, you know, the pro-slavery theologians, Robert Louis Dabney, James Henley Thordwell, A.A. Hodge, these are pastors at the time. They were defenders of the institution of slavery, and they were very upset about the idea of public schools because they precisely, you know, among the ideas, they didn't like the idea of white people having to pay for the education of Black children. They also, you know, claimed that the public schools were atheistic and amoral. Some of their ideas carried through and were, in fact, cited by mid-century theologians such as Rusas John Rush Janney, who is an incredibly influential mid-century theologian, very prolific writer, who is known as a sort of father of Christian Reconstructionism, a religious movement that is still very active today. You know, Pete Hegseth has attended a church that is associated with Doug Wilson, who is one of these sort of Christian Reconstructionist leaders today. And he's actually praised Doug Wilson, Pete Hegseth has. And Rush Janney called public schools atheistic and amoral. He said they train women to be men. This is like back right in the 50s. Just kind of amazing. He wrote a whole screed about it, an 800-page screed, which I have in my bookshelf behind me. I mean, it's just kind of It's so interesting to read these theologians because they had a kind of like complete worldview and a complete theory about this stuff. And you may disagree with it, as I do vehemently, but you can't say that it's totally like it's not well thought through. They really thought through all of this very carefully. And that kind of body of, I would say, a sort of ideology has underpinned a lot of what we're seeing happen, you know, play out today in our politics. I believe it was Rushdoon, he called democracy a heresy.
Huh. It's fascinating because I read in several places in your book, one of the problems with public education is that it's a hotbed of secularism, which is another flash word. And secularism is blamed for every social pathology. They blame secularism for things like homosexuality, feminism, all that, which is apparently abhorrent for these people, but all begins with public school education.
And it comes to this idea, which was partly, you know, derived from the pro-slavery theologians of the Southern Presbyterian Church, and also partly from other strains of kind of religious, like some leading thinkers of the Reformed tradition, who argued that there is no neutrality. There's, you're either with us or you're actively against us. They don't accept the idea. Look, public education, public schools are supposed to be religiously neutral, neither affirming nor denigrating any particular religion, because our society is irreducibly pluralistic. And so this means if you can have a religiously neutral space, keep church and school separate, then you're welcoming to all families and you're keeping the task of education paramount. Right? Without getting into, you know, setting your political agendas, your religious agendas aside, just come together in support of your children and their education, right? But they see anything that is not actively affirming their worldview. I mean, you know, their worldview must be so terribly fragile if anything that doesn't actively affirm it is hostile to it. But that's how they see it.
And so
that's where the sort of atheism and amorality and brainwashing children in godless secularism comes in.
But they're also in an information bubble. So they watch the news that supports their worldview. They read the papers that support their worldview. And they don't get any outside other information.
That's really true. You know, the destruction of public education, as we know it, has been a longstanding aim. But I want to just point out, when I first published a book on the topic in 2012, the religious right activists and the privatizers with whom they were starting to work at that time were the folks who want to privatize education and funnel taxpayer money to private and religious schools. They were kind of discreet about their ultimate aims.
Not anymore.
A few people. No, not anymore. No. Now they say, you know, they're really open about wanting to redirect the flow of taxpayer cash to private and religious and ideologically right-wing schools. So this is what they're, you know, working on. And now we have a case in Oklahoma of a fully like taxpayer-funded religious school called St. Isidore that's going to come before the Supreme Court. So that case would really open the floodgates to direct taxpayer funding of religious organizations and institutions. And this is, again, what our founders referred to as tyranny.
Yeah, we're going to run out of time. We have like 3 minutes left. But you point out in your book many things. But one of them is that the growing acute disparity in wealth is one of the root causes of these attitudes by the rank and file.
That's actually true. And, you know, since we're about to wrap up, I want to say that this movement is internally divided in many respects. I mean, they are sort of rowing in the same boat, as it were. But there are a lot of potential areas of division. And I think the greatest potential for division is between the rank and file, who, when you strip away the religious nationalism, they just really want a better deal for themselves and for the workforce. A lot of them have legitimate gripes about the economy because we've had this, you know, incredible wealth disparities, you know, accumulation of wealth at the tippy top, the Elon Musks, et cetera, and the stripping away of rights for the workforce and you know, making it hard to afford you know, just a decent life. And then the agenda of the funders who want to just sort of keep hoarding all the money that they want. So I think that we are going to see opportunities. We're already seeing them as people lose their jobs, as they lose their Medicare and Social Security.
Oh, yeah.
As the price of goods goes up because of needless tariffs, as our international allies abandon us, as the certain features of the government that people need and deserve and want stop functioning, like the dismantling of consumer protections, et cetera, there is really an opportunity to say to this, folks, here are the people who did this to you, and these are the people who are fighting for you.
And there's already been considerable blowback about Musk. I mean, there really has. People are not happy with him and being in the White House at all.
No, in fact, I think that his whole, you know, showing up with a chainsaw and saying he's going to destroy the woke mind virus, it really shows in a way the nihilism of the movement. This movement is defined, I think, more by what it wishes to destroy.
Well, that's another weird thing that I learned. If you can't own it, break it, seems to be their motto.
Exactly. And when they talk about what they want to create, it's always a kind of imaginary version of a fantasy past that never existed the way that they think it did, but also includes elements of incredibly regressive social order.
We're completely out of time, Catherine, and we could talk about this book for hours, many hours. My returning guest tonight is journalist and author Catherine Stewart, and we've been talking about her new book, Money, Lies, and God: Inside the Movement to Destroy American Democracy. Catherine, it's been a pleasure.
It's a pleasure for me.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.